Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
At this point, we go around and say our names. I'm Bob Sidokan.
Doug Hall.
Joe Kapolka.
Karat Hannah.
Jack Busby.
Joe Good.
Darren Lowe.
Marvin Snow.
Sujoya Grant.
Ruth.
Jim Winters.
Jay Corbett.
Peter Washburn,
Steve Carson,
Howard DeCourt, Michael Murphy,
Buya Maggi,
David Sheeran,
Ricardo Rossini,
Bob Blair,
Michael Langdon,
Paul Shemin,
Peter Marta,
Steve Bryan,
Lee Robbins,
Jim Stewart,
Francis Gates,
Clint Snyder.
Drew Noble.
So we have two speakers today. The first one is going to be Clint. He's been a member of GBF for about 16 years. His first introduction to Buddhism was through the Zen community in the Green Gulch Zen Center in Marin, where he has been the head muffin maker for 17 years. For the past 9 years, Clint has also headed the GBF Feed the Homeless Project, which plans and prepares monthly meals for the Hamilton Family Center, a shelter for homeless families. Clint's spiritual path also includes the Diamond Heart Program and the teachings of Ken Wilber.
Okay, well, good morning. And I want to thank the steering committee for asking me to speak. I'm very flattered, and I hope you all get something out of this. I'll start by saying I'm 56 years old. And the reason why that's a relevant fact is if you do the math, that means I was adolescent back in the mid-60s. Now, I don't know how the younger people in this group, what they know about being gay back in that time or an adolescent at that time. But there was absolutely no information out there about what being gay was like or what it meant. All I knew was that when all the little boys around me were getting turned on by all the little girls, I was getting turned on by all the little boys. So I found this deeply confusing, and I would go and I started asking questions and started sharing my feelings. And I learned a number of things when I started doing that. One, that the feelings I had were deeply shameful and also very disgusting. And two, that my survival depended upon keeping these feelings to myself. So I did that. I became very closeted. I didn't share anything about what was going on inside me with anybody around me. And I tried to get information. There just was none out there at that time. I went to the library. This is before. At that time, being gay was considered a psychopathology, a mental illness, and it was not taken off the list until 1974 by the American Psychiatric Association. I do remember there was this one expose in Life magazine about the sordid homosexual underworld in Greenwich Village, and it's replete with all these lurid pictures of drag queens and black leather sadomasochists and these dingy bars and dark alleys. And it all was very scary and very depressing. I did not want that in my future, so I tried to convince myself that these feelings I had were not my feelings. This went on through high school, through college, and this is during the Vietnam War, so I joined the Navy so I wouldn't be cannon fodder for the Army. So I went on the Navy too. I didn't just keep these feelings from others. I kept them from myself too, thinking this is some kind of phase I was going to be going through. But being on a ship in the middle of the Pacific with 350 hot sailors, it was pretty hard to deny I had these feelings. And I finally just acknowledged that I had those feelings. And I eventually got discharged from the Navy, and I wound up in San Francisco in 1974, and I pretty much plunged myself into the gay world at that time. A stonewall that happened, and gay liberation, quote-unquote, officially started. But I found, from my own experience, from the men I met there at that time, was that we all, or most of us, came from similar backgrounds of being deeply wounded, internalized homophobia, and it was there's a lot of dysfunctional behavior going on, a lot of alcohol and drug abuse, a lot of not treating each other very nicely. And I was in a job at the Veterans Administration at that time, which I didn't like at all, and I was very closeted, very self-loathing, very lonely, and my life pretty much consisted of during the day just spending a job that I hated, and at night just going out and cruising the bars and the baths and the sex clubs, and just having lots and lots of anonymous sex. That was my drug of choice. I didn't get involved in chemicals, fortunately, but to escape the misery that I was feeling, I just drowned myself in sex. After a while, it got so destructive that I pulled back from that for a while. But basically, and this went on. This was not like a brief period. This went on for years. I did a very limited life that was very much involved with being in the closet, keeping my feelings to myself, being very lonely, having no self-esteem, and just figuring that this is going to be my life and just get used to it. So that I couldn't expect to love or be loved or have a life that had any kind of fulfillment or promise to it. And then this one day happened, which arguably could be the most important day of my life. A friend came by, and he said, "I have some acid. Are you interested in taking it?" Now, even though I had grown up in the 60s, I had very little experience with drugs. I'd smoked grass a few times. I didn't really like it that much because it muddled my thinking. I had not dabbled in psychedelics ever before. So, but you know, I just had no problems with that. So sure, okay. This is in February, I think, on a Sunday. And it, like today, like this year, it had been like weeks and weeks of rain. And this is like the first sunny day after all those weeks of rain. And so I went ahead, taken the acid, with no expectation of what would happen. Went out to Golden Gate Park. I got separated from my friend. The thing they say about psychedelics is that they're a very powerful tool. You have to be careful with them because they'll let your inner demons out, or they could. Anything you're suppressing, they will let out. Well, the fact is, my demons were already out. And what I experienced that day was they let my inner angels out. This whole, I just was, the acid kicked in, and all I could feel was just the astounding, amazing beauty of the world around me. Just how incredibly marvelous it was. And people that I normally would have nothing to do with, I just felt in love with them and everybody around me. It was like this part of me that was closed off and sealed off and stoned, and the walls were just torn apart, and all I could feel was just what an amazing universe I lived in. So I just walked through Golden Gate Park, just drunk on beauty, just taking it all in, you know, looking at the sunlight on leaves, looking at a volleyball game, seeing all this stuff and just being amazed by it. And the day ended, by the cliff house, I was up on an elevated hillside, looking down as the sun set in the Pacific, just filled with bliss. So, wow, the acid wore off. I went back to my job the next day. But things were not the same. I had this experience I didn't know what to do with. But I just knew that there was another way of seeing the universe and how I'd been seeing it before. And I had to do something in order to act on this event that happened in my life. So I was doing a number of things. I started exploring spiritual paths. I started reading, and I got involved in therapy of a Jungian therapist named Joe. And I got into that for 13 years, and we just really got into it. We just got into the muck and internalized homophobia and the loneliness and all the distorted lies and misconstrued lessons I've learned over life, and just really just process it through. And the depressions that I've been feeling before, and depressions that would last for weeks at a time and just totally immobilized me when they were there, started lightening up. They started getting less intense. They started lasting a shorter period of time. It didn't happen as often. And I started to heal. So I got to capsulize my life in just a few minutes. So jump ahead. When I was 39 years old, I was in another job that I hated. kind of an occupational history for me. And I figured I had to get out while the getting was good. I was going to be turning 40 soon. And, you know, this is like, if I didn't make the leap now, I would just be stuck in this job for the rest of my career life. So I quit. And I just figured, because I love the outdoors, I used to backpack and camp and hike all the time. I thought, I'll get a job in the environment. And I had kind of unrealistic expectations about what was out there. And I did everything by the book as far as looking for jobs. I bought my college parachute, I did the informational interviews, I got vocational counseling, I networked, and I couldn't find anything. I was living off of my savings. 6 months went by with no job. A year went by with no job. A year and 3 months went by with no job. And this time, I'm really panicking. It's like my money is dwindling down to next to nothing. I just had all these visions of being homeless, of being broke and unemployed. I started going to Green Gulch. I knew nothing about Green Gulch except I loved hiking Mount Tam, and I walked through Green Gulch a few times. Green Gulch is a Zen farm right outside of, you know, right next to Mount Tam. And you know, I didn't really get too much involved with the program there. I just started hanging out at Green Gulch, you know, the fields and the gardens and the hiking trails. And there's one day I went to up the Green Gulch trail at the side of the mountain. It climbs up. And there was this one vantage point. I walked up the trail to this point that overlooks the Pacific. And I was just overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed. Because the thing is, I just assumed that anything I was going to get out of my life, I had to do on my own. That I was not to expect any help from anything or anybody outside of myself. And what I found was that I didn't have enough of myself was not enough. I did everything I could do, and I couldn't find a job. I couldn't resolve this basic problem for me, and it was beyond my powers by myself to do. And I was overwhelmed and filled with dread and anxiety. I just sat on this mountainside, you know, I was just totally emotionally distraught. Tears coming down my face, and I just put it out to the universe. I just said, this is above my ability to do. I cannot do this. I know I cannot do this on my own. I just need help. I need some kind of guidance. And I don't know if you can call it praying. I wasn't really directed towards a specific God or anything like that, but I was just putting out to the universe, I just need help. And the amazing thing happened. I mean, I never really had done that before. And the amazing thing that happened was that the anxiety stopped. And for the next few weeks, it didn't come back. And that was a profound lesson for me. And 2 weeks later, I got the job that I have now with the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, I don't know whether putting that plea or prayer out got me the job, but I do know, you know, who knows? But I do know that by acknowledging that there's more than just that I'm just not self-contained, that I am part of a larger whole, and asking the whole to come in, giving the whole permission to come in, was a profound lesson for me. So I started following the Buddhist practice in Green Gulch and started learning. And the amazing thing is, I've grown up in a very Christian background. And it's just amazing to compare what I was learning through the Buddhism, through Christianity. You know, I really do believe that Jesus was a profound spiritual master, and I love his teachings. But it's just always bugged me to think that there was this one human being in all human history that was enlightened, and nobody else before or after will get to that state. As opposed to hearing about Buddhism, where we are all Buddhas. We all have the potential for being Buddhas, and we all will get there. We're growing towards that, even if it takes a few lifetimes or more than a few to get there. We are all moving towards the Buddhahood that Buddha experienced himself. And then Christianity was, you had to accept all these miracles on faith, virgin birth, resurrection, walking on water, all this stuff that I just found incomprehensible. Versus Buddhism is, you only accept what you experience yourself. And then Christianity, I'm not here to bash Christianity. This is my own experience, that this is the one path that if you don't see it through Jesus, you're going to eternal damnation. At least some of the churches preach that. Versus Buddhism, this is just one of many paths you can follow. If this feels right for you, follow it. If it doesn't feel enough, follow another path. And these were like profound lessons for me. And these sayings that the finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. And if you see Buddha on the road, kill him. These were amazing statements. The whole idea behind the statements, as I understood it, was that this is just a vehicle to try to get some kind of understanding of what you can't understand, of the inexpressible. You don't focus on the vehicle. You just use it for what you can get out of it, and then discard the rest. So, this is what I was learning. It was amazing stuff. And as mentioned in my biography, I started being the muffin maker there. They have like this little lecture and then meditation lecture, and then have this little social period after of tea and muffins. So I would come there early in the morning. I inherited 6 recipes to go around. I bought all these cookbooks, and I typed them all down and expanded them to have like a book of 65 to 70 recipes. I mean, I just got into this. And I started taking, I started not only just meditating, listening to Dharma talks, but taking classes there. And I loved the Green Gulch people, and I loved the Buddhism I was learning. But more and more, I was getting the feeling that there wasn't really quite the perfect fit here. And I remember there was one class about Buddhism and sexuality. And they all were talking about families and kids and committed relationships and marriage. And I brought up, well, can you apply Buddhist Dharma to one-night stands? And there was like this silence. And then there was like this throat clearing and obvious embarrassment. And then they kind of hemmed and hawed and went on to the next topic. And it was like an interesting lesson for me. It's like, my experience as a gay man really isn't being addressed here. In some ways there's something I can relate to. In some ways there isn't. About that time, I heard about, well, at that time it was Gay Buddhist Fraternity, GBF. We changed the fellowship because South was like a frat party. But it was just a small band of gay men who were practicing Buddhists started meeting in this hospice over on Page Street. It was the Zen Hospice. And I started going there. And it was amazing to be with a Buddhist sangha where they were addressing my issues, where we could talk about sexuality and other things. And it was a very powerful experience, a very small group. I mean, it's much smaller than what's here now. And it was just amazing to be part of that community and watch it grow and watch it struggle to define itself. And, it wasn't all sweetness and light. There was infighting and there was, little dramas and stuff. But it was still a community, a sangha for me that I really felt I could identify with in my spiritual path. And it was a haven for me because I didn't really get, I really just didn't want to get involved too much with other aspects of the gay community because I still struggled with this dysfunctionality of it, of what I saw there. Jumps ahead a few years later. I'm still involved in GBF, and I was thinking, this is such a great, powerful resource of people here. It's such a great community. But the journey always just seems to be inner. It's like meditation. I would love to see a balance to it. Outward, engaged Buddhism. And it just so happens, a couple of blocks from where I live, there was a shelter for homeless families called the Hamilton Center. So I just went up to the director there. I said, look, I belong to this group, Gay Buddhist Fellowship. If I can get it together, get the group to go in with this, could we do a meal for you once a month? And, they're a little startled. They said, yeah, okay, sure. So I approached some of the people here in GBF. And we just, and I got all these cookbooks, and I typed out all these various menus, and we just started doing meals there. And at first, it was just, we just pay for our own pocket, we just pass a hat and pay for the food. Eventually, GBF was kind enough to take on and give me a monthly allowance to cover for expenses. But we've been doing that for 10 years now, and it's been a powerful experience of just taking these people who have, you know, such limited, material lives, and you know, eat food that feeds them, but isn't very inspiring. And we make these great meals, and I find for whatever reason I'm drawn towards food as a creative expression, whether it's muffins or these meals. But there's something about taking these ingredients and putting them together and creating these wonderful meals or these wonderful things to eat and having people enjoy them, bringing them together. My favorite holiday is Thanksgiving. The whole idea of just sitting down to a banquet with friends and community and family and just sharing a beautiful prepared meal. So that's been my way of, you know, it's just a drop in the bucket for all the misery out there, but it's been my way, and not just mine, but the people that work with me, and I love them all, that they've just been a wonderful sub-community of people preparing these meals. We just did one yesterday. So then, you know, this is basically where I am right now with GBF. I just want to quickly say, I also have had some experiences. Years ago, I picked up a Ken Wilber book, A Brief History of Everything. Ken Wilber is an integral philosophy, maps out very much about the levels of consciousness. He's a very prolific writer. And I've been involved with a group that just studied this, him profoundly. And through that group, I got involved with A.H. Ames, who starts Diamond Heart, which is kind of like this amalgam of Sufism, Buddhism, Western psychotherapy, integral psychology. And it's been a profound spiritual community for me as well. I'm still involved with that. So I have all these different communities that I'm juggling with in my life and trying to like incorporate them in and make them work together. I am just profoundly grateful that I live in the Bay Area where I had this opportunity. I mean, if I lived in, I don't know, Dubuque or something, I wouldn't have these opportunities. And I'm just really grateful that in my path towards growth and to healing that I have these resources available. I think we're living in very dark times now. I don't know where this country is going, but it's going to a very dark and scary place. And I'm just glad to have these little places of light available to keep the Dharma, to keep the truth and light going, so that as we pass through and get to the other side, hopefully, we'll be able to bring it out again and help make this country into a saner and more evolved place. But anyway, that's basically my talk. I don't know how much of my time I used up.
Thank you.
Hey, I can take a hint. Thank you.
We'll have the second speaker and then we'll have questions afterwards. You want to get up and then This is Jack Busby, who's been a member of GBF for more than a dozen years. He was born and bred in the Middle West, it says here, where he was sincere but not rabid Christian fundamentalist. Living in San Francisco since 1981, he has practiced Vipassana meditation, architecture, and tap dance, but not at the same time. He will be happy if anyone benefits from hearing about his life experience, since he is still puzzling it out.
Well, I guess I made that disclaimer because I make no claim to be a teacher or instructor. This is just some of my life. I was kind of astounded to hear Clint's talk a little bit there, because there's so many parallels that I hadn't expected, especially in the beginning of our lives. But we're the same generation, and it made me realize how common our experiences were in those days, because I was from a little bit of, well, just in terms of the way I thought about this, and it's a good exercise to look at your life sort of autobiographically and try and make it coherent to somebody else. And being here in the Gay Buddhist Fellowship, I realized in thinking about this there are two very strong threads that have been major influences in my life, being gay and being on a spiritual path, which has brought me to Buddhism at this point. And that, not that they're just parallel threads, they've been intertwined in ways that I didn't particularly see initially for years and years, but I think they've really influenced each other. Being gay brought me to spirituality, and spirituality informed my understanding ultimately, I think, of what it is to be gay. So that's kind of how I'm thinking of this little summary of my life. But my biography, just the basic stuff, is actually from a river town outside of St. Louis in the suburbs, very middle class, very middle brow, no poor people, no rich people, all just decent people. We're Methodist and Republican, and a nuclear family that had some of its problematic family dynamics. Whose family does not answer that description? But very early on, before I even had words for it, I knew there was something different about me and something about gayness. Although, as Clint said, when I was a little kid in the 50s and early 60s, and queer was the worst thing you could call somebody on the playground, but we had no idea what that meant, or I didn't at that time. It was just the worst thing possible. I got a little bit more clued into what it was about, but the lesson I learned about gay identity is that something is wrong. Something is wrong with you. There's a fundamental disconnect, a disjunction between what should be and what is within in oneself, myself. And that set my course for decades after that, because my reaction was, oh no, that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable out there, and it's unacceptable for me. And I suppressed it consciously, I thought, at the time. But at that time, I think there was a hidden benefit in that, in that it made me question things, everything about myself and the world and why it was like this. I didn't get answers for a long time. But that questioning, I think, led me to wonder, well, why is the world like it is? Why am I the way I am? What's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of my existence? Even in early years, maybe early adolescent years. And that led me into evangelical Christianity, which was an acceptable outlet for dealing with some of, you know, life's big questions. You know, why are we here? What is our place in the world? How do we deal with the problems of suffering and sin and being good? Not the best outlet, perhaps, I think, in retrospect, but it connected with me in the sense of being a way to explore and to try and figure out what my place in the world. And it also, church at that time, this is junior high and on, became sort of the center of our social lives. It wasn't from a religious family from the beginning, but from the time I was in junior high, we were part of fundamentalist church, and that became the center of our social lives, and it was very warm and embracing. This is long before fundamentalism became so overtly political. A lot of sincere, decent, well-meaning people there, though probably it's definitely limited scope, I think, in retrospect. I was fully committed. I became born again in 1965. I was fully committed to that. And that took me through junior high, high school, college, and into young adulthood, even. And it was not a bad existence, but it was not satisfying, and certainly I wasn't resolved about things in those days, because ultimately, though, the Christianity, being a Christian, does address one view of how the world may be and how we are in it. It didn't resolve these personal issues within me. What is being gay? I mean, I was towing the line. I was living a very Christian life at the time. But increasingly, I began to see that this worldview just did not accord with what I was learning about the way the world is in true life, that there's contradiction and complexity and ambiguity, and things are not black and white, good and evil, which is a very manageable way to view the world, but it's just not true, I think, in that way. And so it took me a long, there was lots of oversimplification, there was a lot of authoritarian, a lot of accepting things on faith rather than through the experience of my own experience. And all this time, I was a straight arrow. I did not have a secret gay life. I was developing a career in architecture and friends, it was okay, but it did not satisfy that core. But eventually, Christianity, by the time I was in my mid-20s, it was just not satisfying my inner drive to figuring out who I was and what I was doing. And I ultimately got up the courage to leave Christianity. But I did not then leap into a life of mindless hedonism. I sort of transitioned, I think, into what was called secular humanism at the time. That was one of those terrible things that Christians should avoid at all costs, being involved in the world. But I did. I was an adult by this time. And I developed my career. I went to grad school. I was involved in literature and art and travel and friendships and relationships and some dating women at the time. And I did not follow or pursue an explicit spiritual path. I was saturated in the ways of the church, and so I was just experiencing the world much more directly. And part of that secular humanism, I suppose, led to a relationship, and I fell in love with a fellow grad student in the university, a woman. And we eventually got married, and we lived happily ever after for a while. It was not a bad life. A lot of it was good, but I wasn't addressing the big secret inside me, because that's what it was. I had never told anyone that I was gay. And not that it came as that much of a surprise to people who knew me when I finally did come out. I thought, you knew? What do you mean? But we had a good life. It was fine. But I didn't know what to do, because I was in this marriage. I was committed to it for life. And I thought at that time that this gay part of my identity was just something that was not going to be expressed this lifetime. Little did I know. And things went along fine for a while until they didn't. And our breakup happened when she met someone else and got involved, and almost instantly, within a few months, she was gone. And this is the big watershed emotional break in my life. And I was totally shocked and wounded and angry and upset. But I was pushing 40 by this time, and I was, I hope, a little bit more mature. And this led to a real reevaluation of everything, the way I'd lived my life, the way I'd thought about life. And we were married and lived here in San Francisco the whole time, and was out on the West Coast by this time. Though I had no real contact with the gay community other than some friends, but nothing direct and experiential. But I thought to myself, that's enough of this. I'd have thought of Popeye's, one of Popeye's lines, which is, I am what I am, and I was going to be who I was. And so here I was in San Francisco, coming out in the gay world at almost 40. And so what an experience, dating for the first time in 15 or so years in San Francisco. And so I learned a lot. I learned a lot about people and myself. It was very, very, very compelling at the time. I learned a lot of things that that many people learn in their teenage years, like a pretty face is not enough, just sex is not enough, just because you're gay with someone else is not sufficient. There's sort of basic tips like that. But I also got to investigating some of the wide range of wonderful resources that San Francisco offers here. There is social groups, a gay drawing group, and GBF, because it had been 10 or 12 years since I'd been exploring a spiritual path, but there was still this urge in me to understand what the world, what I was about, and something beyond just what I'd experienced in the secular world out there. There's something else. And it's interesting, when we were still married, one weekend we went down to Esalen for one of their weekends, sort of the smorgasbord, a little bit of massage, a little bit of transactional analysis, a little bit of this and that. And one of those was a guided meditation, which we were led by the facilitator through a dark forest to a little cottage where an old man had a box with a message in it. And we were to open that box. And the message for me was, it's a gift. And this is in the middle of my married life, and I didn't know what that meant. I thought, I need more. That's not enough. And it was some years later that very specific little experience, which I forgot about for some years, sort of came back to me, and I realized that being gay is a gift for me.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.